Welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm your host, Ruth Amos. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. In this podcast, I chat to all sorts of normal Christians, asking them just how they live their quiet lives and how they integrate their faith into their daily lives. I hope that by listening, you will be encouraged to go out and live your own quiet life to the glory of God. You can find the episode show notes, the Quiet Life blog, and other resources at ruthamos.com.au. That's ruthamos.com.au. Now let's get on with the show. Hello, welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm Ruth, and it's so great to have you here with me. This is episode 34 of A Quiet Life, and as I record this, it is Wednesday, the 12th of June, 2019. And today's guest is Ruth Pinkerton. So not me this time, but a different Ruth. And Ruth has been the leader of SU. I met her at an SU camp, as you shall hear, and SU being Scripture Union. And she shares with us just her journey from Scotland to coming here to Tasmania to lead SU and into what she's doing now. And it was just a fascinating story. I can talk to Ruth for ages. I do regularly. So I enjoyed the conversation. It's a little bit longer than what we usually have. But fascinating to hear, you know, the story of her life laid back. It's amazing how sometimes you look back and see this real nicely laid out plan that, of course, as you're walking through it, you can't see. So there's one particular point in this interview where everything comes together and Ruth sees that this perfect job that where every single part of her life so far has been put together into this final point. And I just think, well, it's not the final point, obviously, but to a particular job. And it's just marvellous. It's just such a great story. Of course, we can't see that, as I was saying, on the way through. When you're looking forward, you've just got to trust and take the next step. But you never know what you might be being prepared for as you take that next step. So that's cool. This week in my life, well, last weekend we ran away. Moz and I got in the car. We drove to Dover and stayed the night there. And then we drove all the way down to Cockle Creek, which is the furthest point south that you can get in Tasmania. And by car, actually, you can walk further, but the furthest point south that you can get by car. And then we went for a further walk, an hour and a half or so out to Fisherman's Point. It was an hour and a half return. I'm not that unfit, not now. But along beautiful deserted beaches with white sand and clear water and through the bush and whatever, we get out to Fisherman's Point, and there's a ruin there, a red brick house ruin, and around that ruin are flowers, fuchsias we saw, and a lily, things that you wouldn't expect to see in the Australian bush, but they've been planted there such a long, long time ago by the people who were living in the little red brick house. It didn't sound like they had as much fun in the little red brick house, but, you know, there they were out on that really south point over the Southern Ocean. So it was just lovely. It was really, really lovely to get away. Then we came back and we ate lunch, and there were all these little fairy wrens around us wanting to eat our lunch. And it was beautiful. And I think, you know, I'm all about living a restful life, and I've changed my life so that it's more restful at home, with varying degrees of success. But I really realised just how important it is to get away from home and just spend some time in other surroundings, in peaceful surroundings, and just enjoy the peace. So that's what we did last weekend, and believe it or not, we're going to do it again this weekend, going in a different direction this time to a different place, but just enjoy a bit of space away, a bit of rest and rejuvenation. So I'm very, very much looking forward to that. And we'll leave Caleb at home to study for his maths exam by himself. He doesn't need our help. Also this week, as I speak to you. My mum is staying at my place. Hooray! So we're having a lovely time together, although I have to work as per usual, which is a bit of a shame. So I shut myself downstairs and on work, and mum's upstairs enjoying herself, I hope. But it's really lovely to have her stay. So yeah, that's where I am at the moment. And so yeah, you'll hear next week, hopefully, lovely stories about my holiday away this coming weekend. I hope they're not too many disastrous stories about my going away this coming weekend. I wonder how you get through the winter and whether you have winter plans that you use to help you get through and to make it through the cold and dark here in Tasmania. If you're not in Tasmania, you may even be in the summer. And that would be so nice. But that's part of the problem, I think. I'm on Facebook and I'm watching all these people from the Northern Hemisphere talk about how wonderful their summer holidays are, and we're stuck here. I mean, it's very, very dark now. The sun gets up at our place. The sun rises at about 8 o'clock because we have a bit of a hill in the way, and it sets near on 4:30. So it's a very short day. That's winter in Tasmania. That's the way it is. We take our vitamin D and try and get out for a walk at lunchtime. But I don't mind it. It's good. You get nice cozy fires and things. So, but it's also good to just get away a little bit and just have a bit of rest, I think. So I am rambling again, obviously in need of a holiday. So I will let you enjoy this wonderful interview with Ruth, and we will chat again at the end. Today's guest is Ruth. Well, sometimes I call her Ruth, which I don't know that she likes. And Ruth and I met just after she came to Tasmania to be the head of Scripture Union here. And we actually met on a Scripture Union camp. So I guess you could say that we have a camp relationship. Anyway, no, it's good. It's an ongoing friendship, a wonderful friendship. And Ruth has had an interesting life, and I thought I would like to share some of her stories with you. So very welcome, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
So start where we always start. How did you become a Christian?
Well, I became a Christian when I was 14. I know I'm one of the people who knows exactly when it happened, but I can definitely detect the build-up to it as well. So I was born into a Christian family, and we went to church regularly. And around the age of 12, a few things happened. I got fed up with church, but I was involved in my SU group at school, my Scripture Union group. And the Gideons came to our school, and they gave everybody a little New Testament Bible. And I remember saying to the guy, I'll treasure this. I don't know. I now think that was a Holy Spirit thing. At the time, I just said it and that was fine. But I kind of took it seriously because I sort of felt I'd made a promise to this guy. So I read it intermittently, but certainly a bit. And then when I was 14, my SU group took me along to a meeting where the evangelist Luis Palau was speaking. And I knew that people went forward at these things. I didn't really know what that was. I remember I wasn't really listening to Luis Palau as it happened. Sorry, Luis. But I was wondering whether my friend would go forward, whatever that was. And I had this sensation of God clearing his throat in my ear. pretty much that's my recollection of it, is that's exactly what it was like. This, you know, somebody really trying to get your attention. And I realized, oh my goodness, you're real. You know, because I had this preamble where I kind of had this idea who God might be. Actually, some of the reading of the Bible was because I thought, if there is a God, he's bound to be impressed or happier if I read the Bible. So here he was, literally chewing up and attracting my attention. And even then, I knew I had a choice. I could just pretend that hadn't happened, or I could go, wow, the God of the universe, who did all these amazing things, is absolutely interested in me. I'll have that.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's how I became a Christian.
And do you want to just tell everyone where you're from?
Just in case for those who haven't worked guessed. Out yet, no, I'm from Scotland. So I was born and brought up in a big town called Paisley, next to Glasgow, in Scotland.
And she went to high school with David Tennant.
I went to the same high school as David Tennant
the same
went
high
to.
School as... Not the same grade, I realise. Cool. All right, so from 14, you decided to be a scientist?
Yes. Well, I was a struggler at school. I'm from a quite academic family, but I appear to be a bit different from them, a bit more limited intellectually, which is hilarious now. But anyway, I'm very like them now. It was a bit of catching up to do. Anyway,
because you were the youngest, I guess.
Well, youngest, but also very premature. I was about 6 weeks premature, which back in those days was a lot. So I suspected that was that aspect of catching up, although one of my nephews has had a similar pattern to his life, and he wasn't premature, so anyway, who knows. I was a struggler at school, but I went to Iceland when I was 14, just after I'd become a Christian. Picture of me reading my Bible in Iceland when I was there, and I just fell in love with volcanoes. I just thought, wow, volcanoes, they are so amazing. I've got to go to university and find out more. And there's an extent to which I didn't know that there was an alternative to going to university. Like, my family would probably have been starting to suggest that maybe there were alternatives. But having come back and said, right, well, I will have to go to university and study volcanoes, they just said, oh, right, okay. And I gathered enough qualifications to do that, and off I went.
Cool. And so did you study volcanoes for a while after uni, or did you go straight
into...
I've
got an honours degree in geology, and which is what everybody does in the UK. Here honours seems to be the exception. Right, there, it's completely the norm.
So you're totally qualified to lick rocks now, is that right?
Well, indeed. Certainly get my nose on them, as many a lecturer shouted at us. Get your nose on those rocks. I don't think I licked any of them, to be honest, but there you go. So I did that. I had 4 years of doing that, and then I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? And I had a place on an MSc at a very prestigious mining school. And I remember asking them, you know, what the likelihood of getting a job coming out of this was, and especially as a female. Mm. And they just laughed and they said, everybody gets a job coming out of our course, even the ones who don't pass the course.
Okay.
Anyway, I then said to them, could I defer that for a year? I'd gone to university at 17, and it's a 4-year degree, but still I was fairly young and I'd never stopped to really think and consider. And they said, yeah, no problem, you can defer for a year. So I thought, okay, what'll I do? And I had a really I kind of looked around for a number of things. I was doing various kind of mission activities over summer, as I'd done each summer of university. And then it got to the end of summer, I thought, oh, blimey, I'm not going back to university, better get a job. So I was looking around for a job, and I actually got offered 3 jobs in 1 week after a little bit of searching, not too long. And one of them was to be a chalet girl in the Alps, which I love skiing, and that was very tempting. And another was to do market research on British Rail.
Exciting.
I know, the interviewer seemed very impressed by my encyclopedic knowledge of the train service between Glasgow and Aberdeen, which is I'd studied in Aberdeen. And the third one was to go to a residential school in the south of England and look after intellectually disabled epileptic teenagers.
Okay.
So the reason I didn't go and do the chaleying was that I thought, if I do that, I will come back in the spring and I'll be no further forward with my thinking about what I'd actually like to do with my life.
Yeah.
Whereas I thought, oh, maybe there would be some opportunity to kind of look at therapy in action, and maybe I suppose I'd thought I was quite an active outdoors person. I thought I might be a physiotherapist or something like that if I didn't pursue the geology. Anyway, so basically I went and worked with special needs kids.
And how did that change your thinking about the future then?
well, there were two things I was, and I use this word hesitantly, two things I was never going to do
right. When
I was coming out of university. And I have pretty much stopped using the word never, because it's a very dangerous word. I recommend people not to use it. One of the things I said I'd never do was work in a bank, which so far I have not done, and I have no ambition to do so. But you have.
I have, yeah.
The other was that I would never be a teacher.
Yeah.
And the reason that I didn't want to be a teacher was that I didn't think I had enough patience to be a teacher. Well,
fair.
Indeed. I worked with a group of young people who would have tried the patience of, well,
yeah.
a saint in the broadest sense of the word. And so it was this opportunity for God to say, you know, you could do this. And in actual fact, to recognise, I knew all along, I am a teacher. Mm. You know, it doesn't matter if I work in a school or not. That's one of my primary giftings. I knew that when I was a patrol leader in the guides.
Right.
So yeah. I used to teach my recruits and make their entry into guides much easier because I could teach them. So anyway, so in fact, after a year of working with these special needs kids, I thought, okay, I give in, Lord, I'll go in to Teachers College and I'll use my science to teach people. But I was too late to apply to start that year, and so I had another year to use. And so instead of staying where I was, I actually went to work for a church in London. And again, that was another rich part of the experience of developing who I was and how I could serve God.
Mm. So it sounds very much to me like both missions and teaching have just been in there inside you and coming out at every opportunity.
Yes, since you put it like that, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Cool. So obviously you went to Teachers College, you became a teacher. I remember you saying you were teaching in London, were you?
Yeah, that's right. I had a little, my first temporary teaching job, which could have been permanent, but was on an island off the west coast of Scotland with 2 and 4 children in each of my certificate classes. So I thought, no, nice. If I stay there, I will never teach in the real world.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had already landed a job in London, so I went down and taught there.
And we've talked a bit about your philosophy of being a faith-filled person in a teaching situation. Would you like to talk about that?
When you're teaching in the state system, you are somewhat limited in what you can do. You're not there to proselytize, but if you are a Christian, then I would hope that kind of shows. I think most of the people in school, both staff and pupils, would have known that I was a Christian, but I wasn't really actively involved in anything Christian in the school. But when I left, my leaving speech was completely the gospel, straight down the line. Like saying, I know you think that I think that photosynthesis makes the world go round, but actually...
Wow.
Yeah, because I was actually teaching biology, just to be fair. There's not a lot of photosynthesis in geology so but I taught a lot of biology and some earth science as well.
Yeah, that's the fun thing. You train to teach one thing, you teach whatever they need you to teach at the time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so could we have a quick rundown of the journey between teaching and Scripture Union?
Sure. Okay, so... So there was teaching in London for 4 years and going back to that same church and being really involved in that and then just having fabulous holidays and, you know, literally I would leave on the last day of term, I'd be heading out of town with my baggage going wherever I was going, doing what I was doing. It got very tiring. I really exhausted myself by trying to live my 100% of my life in all three areas.
Yeah,
And so I suppose I... I got slightly burnt out, but also just thinking, I'm sure I could do something more fun than this teaching. What do I like about teaching? Well, I love it when the light bulb comes on above their heads. I love helping people understand things they didn't understand before. Mm. I love the geology field trip out there, science field trip. I love the biology field trip. I love the geography field trip. I love the school ski trip. Oh, is there a pattern here? What don't I like about teaching? Well, I loathe marking with a vengeance. I just hate it so much. And I hate my life being ruled by a bell. And I hate that I'm indoors most of the time. And I hate that I can't share my faith as openly as I would like to. So I thought, maybe I'd like to work with kids in the outdoors. Maybe that would be the thing. And so we don't have time to go into it, but I had a connection with somebody in a summer camp in Canada, a Christian summer camp, and she'd said to me, oh, come anytime, we'll give you a job. So I kind of basically said, can I come? And they said, yeah, sure. And so I went over to this summer camp and I worked there and doing, well, actually what happened, I didn't really have any of the sort of teaching skill, the technical skills that they were after, like they did swimming and hiking and teach and archery and so they, I'd done a little bit of archery, so they said, oh right, okay, good, you can do the archery stuff. Well, it turned out that my teaching ability, I could transfer that to the young staff who knew how to do archery, and then they could teach archery much better. And this weekend, well, it was so obvious that you were
training the trainers.
Yes, that I was immediately asked if I could do that to other trainers doing other things as well. And I said, well, I think so. And so I then, I only had a group of kids for a fortnight, and then I got moved to Staff Hill and I was the trainer of the trainers. And oh, it was just, yeah, it was a bit crazy. But anyway, it was all good fun. Yeah. And but more importantly than any of that really was that I met this lovely New Zealander there, this girl, Glynis Erskine, and Glynis Mackie as she now is. And she said, oh, Scotland, I love Scotland. I used to work for, and it was a Christian organisation in Scotland called the Abernethy Trust. And I said, oh, and I knew about them and I'd been on one of their courses. And I said, oh, I'd love to work for them. And her actual words were, well, why don't you ask them for a job? They'll give you one. So I thought, well, okay, maybe. I still don't have any qualifications as such that might help them. Anyway, I chatted with my dad, who's a wise man, and he said, well, why don't you reconnect with Abernethy? So I went to their New Year house party with a friend, and I had filled in an application form but hadn't submitted it. And so I got chatting with the chief exec, as you do. And I said, he said, oh, would you like to work for these, for the Canadians? He knew about my connection with the, they've got a kind of staff exchange going on. And I said, well, and I knew it was a bit, ugh, but I said, I'd rather work for you. It's like, oh, you should fill in an application form. I'm like, well, here's one I prepared earlier. Anyway, upshot was I got a job working in their Arran Centre. So Arran is an island on the west coast of Scotland, a bit bigger than the previous island that I'd been on. And so I worked for them for 4 years. And it was great, loved it, and became the senior instructor there. And again, worked, felt a lot of the impact of my work and who I was working with the staff that we had, young staff, and encouraging them and giving them confidence. So that was great. But then I damaged my knee really badly, twice. No one go into the details, but basically after the second one I needed a reconstruction, which meant I had to keep off rough ground for a year. And so obviously being on rough ground was kind of my job. So I was immediately, it's interesting to reflect, this is kind of how I was with God in those days. I was immediately flared up, cross with God about what was he playing at. Here I am serving.
What possibly good could come out of this?
Exactly. But then I kind of simmered down and I thought, well, at least a year is a reasonable amount of time. I could do something with a year. And so I thought, well, what's kind of missing from my CV, if you like? And I thought, well, I don't have any kind of business knowledge, or certainly not any academic study. So I actually was able to go to university and study for an MBA, a Master's in Business Administration. And halfway through that, I guess, just praying about this and thinking, if I go back to being a outdoor instructor with this qualification, this degree will turn out to be the world's most expensive occupational therapy. And so I told the trust that I wasn't coming back to that job, and they were sympathetic, and that's how it was, so that's fine. And then I finished off my degree, which was an amazing experience because there was people there in that course from about 40 different countries. Mm. And remember, there was a group of guys from the Arab world who actually said to me, we've never met a Christian who knows what, who can express what they believe before.
Oh, wow. So,
yep. Anyway, so that was sort of good opportunities too. Finished up with that, and then said, okay, Lord, here I am. You know, I've got a teaching qualification. I've worked with special needs kids. I've worked in the outdoors. I've recovered from a knee injury. I've got this MBA. How can I serve you? And there was basically deafening silence for quite a while. Quite a few months, certainly a few months. And I had no money left. And, you know, I was fortunately living in a flat that belonged to my parents, so I had a roof over my head, but there was no money. And I didn't want to kind of go on the dole or claim benefits, so I had a little part-time job in a bookshop, and just to have some pocket money in. And I was just searching and looking for the right job and praying and saying, God, how can I help you? And I had a group of teenagers who were meeting in my flat for Bible study each week, which was organised by a friend of mine who worked for SU Scotland. And so one night her boss came around and said to me, who are you? What do you do? I was like, well, I'm Ruth. I'm looking for a job, actually. And she said, oh, why haven't you applied for this job? Which is kind of, this is how I used to behave when I was the head of SU. You're always on the scout for good stuff. And so this was a job which was just like my friend's job, but was in an adjacent geographical area. And I said, oh, well, I could apply. I said, I'm not sure it's the right job for me, because, I mean, obviously I like young people. Here they are in my house and learning the Bible and all that. But actually, I think my main focus is more on helping, interacting with adults and helping them. She said, no, that's what this job is about. It's about helping people work better with young people. I think you'd be brilliant at it. So, I mean, SU was obviously really important to me. They were part of my faith journey, and I value the organisation, and here's one of their senior staff tell me to apply for a job, and I've got nothing in the pipeline. I've been praying for months for some opportunity.
Yep.
So, what's a girl to do? So I applied for the job, and they interviewed me, and they offered me the job. And with as much conviction as I believed God was present with me when I became a Christian, I believe God said, no, you're not to take that job.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I found myself phoning her up and saying, well, you know, thank you. Really love SU, but actually I'm really sure this is not the job for me. So I think she usually gets the opposite of people phoning her up saying, why didn't I get the job? God told me I would get the job. Anyway, so she said, oh, well, that's very disappointing, but that's life. And then about, I don't know, 10 days later, 8-10 days later, her opposite number in the camping and holidays section of SU Scotland phoned me up. She said, I've got this other job. And this other job, they were looking for somebody who had a teaching qualification or background, ideally somebody who knew a bit about the outdoor industry in Scotland. If they'd worked with special needs, that would be excellent. If they could bring some kind of business and marketing knowledge to the thing, that would be really helpful. pretty much had Ruth Pinkerton, please apply. And so it was like, oh, that's why I had to say no, because that job hadn't actually been quite formulated yet. And there it was. And yeah, that was absolutely the job for me.
Yeah, wow.
Mm-hmm. So I did that for 7 years. And then I was sort of headhunted in the SU sphere to the job that I came out to do in Tasmania. So yeah, that was a long time. That was a long story to get here. Anyway.
No, it's good though. And I think it's obvious to me, like, if you tell somebody, you know, Ruth came from Scotland to serve as the head of SU down here in Tasmania, people would say, well, why Tasmania? But from your life story, it's like, well, that's, you know, you're just that kind of person. Yeah, let's try Tasmania.
Yeah. And I was a contentedly single person as well. And so that made that decision so much easier. Mm. You know, if I was married, obviously my spouse would have had to have found a job here or got a visa, or, you know, it would just been so much more complicated. So it was, I mean, it wasn't a small decision, but it was definitely a good one.
Yeah. So if somebody's listening and they're sort of feeling like they're at the beginning of the journey, what sort of advice do you have for them?
Ooh. I can remember wishing, I sometimes still do, that maybe when you became a Christian, God should just put a nose ring through your nose so it could lead you more easily. But I would say that you just have to pay attention to who you are and who God is, you know. And actually, there are a number of paths in life, I believe. I don't think, like, if you've done something that you then think, well, maybe I should have done something else, that's not disaster, that's not the end. There are a number of options. I could have stuck with the science option. I could have done a number of things. I'm thrilled with what I have decided to do and been able to do. But I think, yeah, if you are making decisions in good conscience with God, you can't really go wrong.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And nice. He totally forgives you if you turn out not to have been in good conscience with Him.
So do you have a couple of stories from your time here with SU?
Sure. So, it's just been brilliant to come here and do this. And I've met so many amazing people, not least yourself, Ruth. That camp was great.
It was.
I mean, for me, it was largely great because I got to know you. I've got such a good friend out of it.
I know. I have to say, it's the same for me because I don't go on camps anymore because it's not part of who I am. So I'm very glad I was on that one.
Yes. Well, camps are really important. They are, you know, we call them a temporary Christian community. And so I have loved being part of seeing camping, SU camping, grow in Tasmania. We run about twice as many camps as we used to do. And so that's very exciting. I love when people, obviously, people get to know God. I love when people get to hearing children pray for the first time. Like, that's just amazing. But also, again, for me, a lot of the time I've been like the camp leader, though I'm the director. And so my main focus has actually been on the team. And I've loved just to have that sense of being able to inspire and give confidence and lead people. But sometimes you don't do that well. So I remember one time we were about to run a primary camp, and I was directing it at short notice, so I didn't know the team, but the team leader had for a very reasonable reason hadn't suddenly been able to do it. So I was in there leading. We were there the night before. The weather was absolutely shocking, and I'm meeting this team pretty much for the first time. And I say to one of the guys, "Oh, will you say grace before our evening meal?" And because that's what I said. And the look on his face, I mean, rabbit in the headlights was not in it. He looked terrified. I thought, oh dear. And I thought, well, and I would have been happy to, you know, extract him from that. I hadn't in any way wished him to feel awkward. But he sort of, I watched him kind of gird himself and say, I can do this. And then he prayed out loud, just a grace for thankfulness for our food. And And then he then told me, I've never prayed out loud before.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, not only was that an amazing experience for him, but he really hasn't stopped since. I mean, it just was, I mean, it was a bit like I had an experience of that when I was 15 at school, first time I prayed out loud, and that sense of release, and now you can do it kind of anytime, anywhere. And so that was just, that was a really...
He was thrown off the cliff and found out he could fly.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't normally go around throwing people off cliffs.
Sure, sure.
Anyway, that was a great moment. So, yeah, that was good.
And chaplaincy has been really big during your time here too.
Oh, yes, it has. It was one of those things. I came in 2007, and so literally just before I was confirmed as I was coming was when John Howard made the announcement that the government was going to be funding or part funding chaplaincy. And I kind of thought, why didn't you just tell me about that, God? Like, I think it would have still come. But anyway, so I had been thinking, I can do that SU TAS thing. You know, SU, Tasmania, the population's about a tenth the size of Scotland. SU TAS is about a tenth the size of SU Scotland. I can lead something that size, that scale. And then, of course, it just grew and grew so that it was substantially larger than that because of the amount of chaplaincy we did. We had over 100 chaplains at the at the peak. So yeah, it was huge, and it was also, it's just such a fabulous ministry. Again, that getting alongside people, I think we have to recognize that we live in a culture where there's multi-generational ignorance of anything to do with Christianity. And so how do they find out anything about Christians? Well, they meet this Christian who they decide is cool. Why did they decide that? Not because they actually are, but because they care about them, you know, because they're there. And chaplaincy is a presence in school which is regular and ongoing, and that makes such a difference to people. So yeah, it's been absolutely fantastic to be involved in that, and again to kind of support chaplains and to help them understand who they are and what their gifts are. I remember doing some training which was for leading camps, but leading missions, and there was a chaplain who was very nervously thinking that maybe she could do this leading a mission, and we explored some the idea of leadership and what it meant, and we talked about what the world understands to be leadership, and that sounded great. And then we looked at what leadership is described in the Old Testament, particularly in relation to the kings and what they were meant to be, it was that light bulb coming on moment where she really understood what the spiritual difference in being a spiritual leader is. And my goodness, her ministry has just gone from strength to strength. She leads that mission every year, but she also has a club that runs fortnightly throughout the year, and the kids absolutely love to come to that. And for so many children particularly, clubs at school or after school or camps, they kind of are church for them. If they've got a family that's got nothing to do with church, then the family doesn't tend to, sometimes they do, but often they don't start going to church just because the kid comes home and says, hey, had this amazing experience that they can't very well articulate. So she's actually in a sense really ministering to those children. Building up their faith and discipleship.
That's awesome. So you're heading in a new direction now.
Hell, it's true.
Could tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Yes. So it's new in the sense that I've finished up with SU to do it. But actually, I realised on reflection, it's not particularly new. I think I've been involved in this for about 7 years, actually, which is, and for those who don't know, I'm involved in conflict management. And I did some training with a group called Peacewise, and I really loved their basic training in conflict management. But as I did more kind of thinking about it and thought, oh, I think I need to study this, find out more about it. So I looked around to see if there was the right course for me to do, and I went and did a master's in conflict management and resolution from James Cook University. So I finished that last year, so I've been doing that slowly part-time, and of course I've been, you know, using my skills and assisting people. And I guess what I really noticed was how many people are stuck there. They seem kind of paralysed by conflict that they're either in or that they're worried that they'll be in. I also think, to be honest, that the church has not handled conflict very well. You know, there's been awful things said and done, like people have been encouraged to put up with utter sinful behaviour on other people's part, and and told that they should graciously put up with it. Well, that's for me, things about understanding conflict in a Christian context are that you should first of all seek to glorify God, and to put up with, for example, domestic violence. That is not glorifying to God, and so that shouldn't be happening, and the church should never be encouraging people to do that. But yes, the church should be encouraging people to get their perspective right about conflict, and work out how can we glorify God. And then the next thing is, how do you get the log out of your own eye? It's really helpful to start by thinking, how have I contributed to this? Even if it's 99.9% their fault in your mind. What is that 0.05% that you've actually contributed yourself? That's very helpful thinking. And then thinking about, if you are going to go to somebody and, if you like, correct them, thinking about how you would do that, or how you would like to receive correction if it was coming in your direction. I think if we did a bit more thinking about that, that would be really helpful. So yes, you might want it done kind of privately, or you might want it done gently, or you might, or in fact, you might not want everybody to do it. You might just want one person that you had a good relationship with to do it, or something like that. And the other is that we should actually commit ourselves to ongoing relationships, to actually reconciling with each other where that's possible, instead of just going, oh yes, well, we forgave each other, but of course we never talk to each other anymore.
Yes, which people tend to think is the easier way to go, but...
Yes, and it is the easier way to go, to be fair. You know, there's a lot of effort involved in this, so we actually do have to work out which relationships are worth the effort that it's going to take to make them work.
Yeah, well, so that's going to...
Yes. So, yes, I'll be doing... That's my new business, Amity CMR, which is Conflict Management Resolution. And I train people, so I can do groups, training in groups, helping them to be more relaxed about conflict and see that it can be a good thing. I do coaching, where I work with one party in conflict. So often people say, oh, the other person... Like, either they just have no idea how to approach it, or they say they won't mediate, they won't talk about it, they won't whatever, and they think that they're then stuck. So coaching can help them understand that that's not necessarily the case, that they've got lots of options. And then the other is to actually get involved where a conflict has already arisen, and often that's where there's somebody who's kind of nominally in charge of the situation, and they just are going, I don't know what to do, and so they can call me.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. And we will put all that in the show notes. Hooray. Okay, so we near the end now, but when do you feel close to God?
Oh, that is a very interesting question. Because I thought, oh yeah, there is that question. People often ask that question.
Yes.
I don't have a good answer, but now I do, so that's good.
Oh,
so
excellent.
Thanks for giving me a chance to reflect on that. I often hear people say, oh, I feel close to God when I'm in the garden. I think when I'm in the garden, I think, oh, maybe purgatory's real. People say, I feel close to God when I'm, you know, bushwalking. And I think, oh, I'm very pleased for both these groups of people. But I think when I'm bushwalking, I'm too busy thinking, oh, a butterfly. Oh, a view. Oh, what kind of tree is that? I'm not. So then I thought, gosh, maybe what is the answer? Mm. And the answer is that actually there's no one specific time or place that I feel close to God. I feel close to God when I'm engaging with him, or he's engaging with me. And that can happen anytime, and it can happen in good times, in bad times, you know, things can be very difficult, and so you I immediately kind of turn to God and say help. And then I can feel very close to him. Or things can be absolutely wonderful and marvelous, and I can say, wow, God, you know, this is amazing. Or he can speak to me through, you know, reading the Bible or praying or a sermon or a song or something. But there's no specific answer to that, but it's when I'm open to engaging with God, because he's always open to engaging with me. And whenever I am, I feel close to him.
Nice. And finally, what's one thing about God or Christianity that you wish everyone knew?
Well, I think this is a common answer, but it's so true, that I want people to know that God loves them. And I just think sometimes Christians are bad at helping people understand that. You know, God has loved us so deeply, so much. He can love us no matter what we've done, what kind of lives we've led, whether we've been obedient or not. He can still love us, and I just want people to know that. He really loves you.
Awesome. Thank you very much for sharing with us, Ruth.
You're very welcome.
Wasn't that great? I hope you enjoyed our fun conversation. Next week, I speak to Marlene. Marlene is a new friend of mine from St. Luke's, and she has worked as a teacher of speech and drama. And she still teaches speech and drama. And we had a lovely little chat. It's a shorter one next week, so it makes up for this week. Anyway, I want to thank Catherine Joy from Joy Music House for the music. Thank you very much, Matt, for the transcription, which was done at short notice. And I want to remind you that if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me, ruth@ruthamos.com.au. Find me on Facebook at Ruth Amos Author, or Twitter at A Quiet Life. And I would love to hear from you, especially about how you're getting through the winter. And I will see you next week.